Welcome to the townhall.com weekend journal brought to you by the Salem Radio Network. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Today we hear from experts on the military as Putin continues to bully Ukraine while President Obama issues warnings.
I'd rather us act like we don't care than act like we care, but we're not willing to do anything.
As Russia and China build up their troops and military strength, the American military faces massive budget cuts.
We are going to be losing that battle-hardened veteran, that first sergeant or that major who has deployed four or five times and has that kind of combat experience.
And later, a man with a plan takes on Obamacare.
The problem is his bill has been extremely ideological, extremely liberal in its design, and it's really intended to give government more control of our health care.
All this and more coming up on the townhall.com weekend journal. Thank you for joining us. This week, the conflict in Ukraine heated up once again. As Russian President Vladimir Putin expressed his right to send in more troops, U.S. President Barack Obama continued to play the role of a bad parent, issuing threats but with no real consequences. At the same time, our military is facing drastic and dramatic, debilitating budget cuts. It's ironic, given that the federal government is pulling in more money than at any time in history. I discussed the problem earlier this week with former Senator from Missouri, Jim Talent. You know, I want to turn to Army readiness like we talked about last week. But before I do that, two late-breaking pieces of news. President Obama called the French president today to say if Putin does bad things in Ukraine, we'll really stand up to him. Do you think that matters to Putin anymore?
Well, clearly it doesn't, given what he's doing. In fact, I think all of these warnings are having a negative effect. In other words, if we're not going to actually do anything, I'd rather us not issue these warnings and talk so much, because it just makes us appear weak.
I agree with that. And we're issuing a warning a day now, and he just keeps on doing what he wants to do.
You know, it comes down to this. I mean, I'd rather us act like we don't care than act like we care, but we're not willing to do anything, because then that'll infect. In other words, that infects our decision making across the board. That tells other leaders around the world that the United States is not going to stand up for its own interests. I'd rather define our, if we have to choose, I'd rather define our interests narrowly and let them believe that where we do think something is important, we'll actually, you know, try and defend it. General Breedlove, who's the commander of NATO's forces, has been pretty clear about this, that what Putin has amassed on the eastern border of Ukraine is adequate, is more than adequate to go through the rest of Ukraine into, you know, Moldova if he wanted to, like a knife goes through cheese. I mean, we don't have anything there that could stop him. And, you know, if we want to get Putin's attention, we're going to have to forward position troops in Eastern Europe. No, we're going to have to act like a country that cares about what's going on there. And, you know, it begins with having the troops to put there, which means we're going to have to rebuild the military.
This afternoon as well, the acting president of Ukraine asked the United Nations for troops, for peacekeepers, to sort of stand in the way as bowling pins if Putin decides to roll through. Yeah. I don't know that will help him at all.
No, it shows how desperate he is that he's asking for peacekeeping troops from the UN. I mean, I don't think that's going to make much difference, although forward basing any units in areas that Putin might go through would at least clearly raise the stakes to him. In other words, it would be an attack not just on Ukraine, but on, in that case, I guess, the UN. But to me, it's an act of desperation on the part of the Ukrainian president. I understand it, given the situation that he's in. But, you know, this situation could be controlled, I think, I don't want to say easily, but a concerted effort by the United States and its allies to build up their military to a reasonable level, to forward base well-trained and well-equipped troops, would probably contain the Russians. I mean, it's not like Russia is anywhere near as powerful as it was when the Soviet Union existed.
That would mean forward basing in the Baltic countries, in Poland, possibly in Romania, and that's all doable under our NATO agreement, isn't it?
Sure, yeah. I mean, we can do that, or we can revise the policies of the past to make that possible. There's a number of other things that we can do. We certainly ought to support the Ukrainian government. We ought to have strong sanctions. But I can't think of an instance where sanctions have worked on their own in this kind of situation. It needs to be done with other kinds of actions that show collective kinds of security. And it's, in other words, you increase the cost of doing this sort of thing to the aggressor. and the certainty that they're going to that costs are going to be imposed upon them, and then you deter the aggression.
Now, over the weekend, you sent me a little note about Task Force Smith and the fact that there's a monument to Task Force Smith that people really don't know about, and tells us it's a warning, actually.
Yeah. The problem is that because of the cuts to the defense budget, the military's having now day-to-day readiness is being degraded, and one of the key aspects of that is training. So the Army's not training its units above the company level, except for the units that are going to Afghanistan. Essentially, that's what's happening. Well, you know, so they're training the soldiers in marksmanship and that sort of thing, but they're not training them as units. Well, that means that the young soldiers don't know how to engage in different kinds of combat. The company commanders and platoon commanders don't know how to maneuver their units in combat, and the battalion and brigade commanders, they've never had any experience in driving and training their staffs and logistics and that sort of thing. So they're not trained for the, you know, the Army used to say the more sweat in training, the fewer casualties in combat.
And of course, above company, you've got brigade and battalion, and making those all work together in concert requires rehearsal. That's your point.
Right, especially in today's warfare. I mean, if you want to be able to project power effectively and with the fewest number of casualties. Now, Task Force Smith is everybody in the Army knows what Task Force Smith is. It was what happened was after World War II, we cut the budget too much because of the rush to go to peacetime status. And the Army was poorly equipped and poorly trained. And then, wow, well, we're surprised the unexpected happens. The North Koreans invade South Korea. And the Army sent in a unit of 400 men. Most of them were teenagers who'd had only 8 weeks of basic training, and their equipment couldn't stand up to the North Korean Army. Well, they held heroically for about 7 hours, but they were overwhelmed. They retreated in a disorganized fashion and left their wounded on the battlefield, and the wounded were shot by the North Koreans. And afterwards, a monument was erected to this group of men. They were called Task Force Smith. It's a monument to the folly of political leaders who, you know, are weary of past wars, and so they don't prepare for the future ones. And it's the men and women in the military who suffer when that happens, because they go anyway. I mean, if they have to go, they go, but they don't have what they need, and more of them don't come back.
Now, talking with former Senator Jim Talent, what's the turnover? You know, a lot of people think, well, our Army must be so experienced and so battle-hardened after 13 years in Afghanistan and all those years in Iraq. But in fact, new recruits are coming in every day, and new lieutenants and new captains who've never actually heard a shot fired in anger.
Well, that's right. And they've been constantly fighting for the last 10 years, but they've been fighting in one particular kind of mission, which is counterinsurrection. And I had a concern even before these cuts that the Army was not trained in other kinds of missions, like, you know, combat maneuver, the traditional kinds of combat on the battlefield. And this is going to get worse now that they've had to cut training funds.
Now, you mentioned NATO General Breedlove. He was on the Hill last month, and he was being as close to a blunt as a uniformed member of the American military services can be about not being ready.
Yeah, and this is all over the service. I mean, you can't talk to a senior officer without them telling you what's happening. I mean, you know what? I mean, the Navy is shrinking. They just pulled half their cruisers, you know, basically out of deployment. The secretary's talking about doing the same thing with 3 or 4 carriers if this continues. So the Navy is not deploying. They're not maintaining, doing the deep kind of maintenance that they should be doing. The Air Force is shedding aircraft and retiring them so that they don't have to maintain them because they don't have enough money. And people in Washington act like this doesn't matter. Well, if it doesn't matter, why have the military in the first place, right?
Arkansas Representative Tom Cotton is an Army vet, a Ranger, and another one of those concerned with the damage these cuts will do to our fighting men and women. Cotton also happens to be challenging Mark Cryer for Senate in the Razorback state of Arkansas. We spoke earlier this week. Now, I want to switch over to something I talked about with former Senator Jim Talent last hour. It has to do with the Army, and therefore your background as a Ranger and a combat veteran of Iraq and Afghanistan would matter. Jim Talent's making the argument that the Army is now down to company-only training. They're not doing brigade and battalion training, and that this will greatly degrade force readiness. What's your reaction to the senator's concerns?
Well, Senator Talent is right to be deeply concerned about it, Hugh. In any standard train-up cycle, like the kind that my units were going through back at the peak of the Iraq War, you start at the very lowest level at individual training on individual rifle marksmanship, and you move up through team, squad, platoon, and company training, but you certainly don't stop there. You move on to battalion and brigade level training as well, and only then are you truly ready to deploy to fight and win our nation's wars. But because of the radical cuts to defense from the Obama administration, not just future procurement or not just future size of the military, but current operations and maintenance and training is being cut not through fat, not through muscle, but all the way down to the bone.
He's also concerned, and I brought it up with him, and he iterated that this is correct, that we have turnover in the Army, so that even though the Army's been fighting for a dozen years in Afghanistan and Iraq, there are new enlisted men, new officers coming online who haven't done that and don't know how to do the battalion and brigade level maneuvers. Do you share that worry?
Of course, Hugh. Every year you have thousands of new privates, new lieutenants coming out of basic training, coming out of West Point or ROTC or officer candidate school, and they're not hardened combat veterans the way so many of our senior sergeants and our captains and majors and colonels are. And they need that kind of training because they're not being exposed to that kind of fighting environment overseas right now at the numbers they were in the last decade. But also, that's one reason why it's so disastrous to be cutting our military so dramatically, because we are going to be losing that battle-hardened veteran, that first sergeant or that major who has deployed four or five times and has that kind of combat experience.
Last question. In the big battle over the benefits of career military, Mark Pryor voted to cut those. You voted not to, and then you fought to get him put back in. He was embarrassed by that, and he did some backpedaling. Have retention rates shown any wear and tear yet as a result of the first strafing run over the benefits of career military?
Hugh, I haven't seen data if they have. You know, that was a relatively short period, you know, 8-9 weeks that it remained. But I was worried in part that if they stayed on the books for good, you would see retention be hurt. But the main thing hurting retention right now is the overall level of cuts. I mean, soldiers just don't think that they're going to have a job in the future, and they're preparing to leave the military because they know that they're stuck at a certain rank or won't be able to progress along a career path anymore.
Coming up, Governor Bobby Jindal explains the issue.
The problem is this bill has been extremely ideological, extremely liberal in its design, and it's really intended to give government more control of our health care.
And Bobby Jindal gives the alternative when townhall.com Weekend Journal continues in a moment. Welcome back to the townhall.com Weekend Journal. I'm Hugh Hewitt. In the short time since the so-called Affordable Care Act came up for debate, Republicans tried repeatedly to steer the massive legislation towards a more palatable direction. And they were forcefully turned away by a House and Senate controlled by Democrats. The bill was passed, it's worth remembering, without a single Republican vote. Now what is known as Obamacare is clearly a mess and getting worse. Once again, a Republican has stepped forward with a better idea, a much better idea. Salem radio host Michael Medved spoke with Governor Bobby Jindal of Louisiana.
Now, I was particularly eager to talk to you about a couple of things that you've said and a couple of proposals that you've made, particularly what I consider to be your very exciting alternative to Obamacare. This is not just a few tweaks around the edges of the president's failed program. It's a very different program that would serve the people a lot better. Explain how.
Michael, you're exactly right. I start off by saying we've got to repeal and replace Obamacare. It's not enough to make small changes to it. You know, my background's in health care policy. I was on the bipartisan Medicare Commission. I was the executive director. I was the secretary of Louisiana's Department of Health. I was an assistant secretary in the National Health Department. And I think the president needs to stop saying that conservatives don't have an alternative. One of the things I've spent my background, my career in health care, and his plan simply doesn't work. The difference is, we've outlined a detailed plan, 16 specific proposals, over 25 pages. We talk about decreasing the role of federal government insurance bureaucrats. We talk about giving power back to patients and their doctors. We help encourage states to innovate rather than a one-size-fits-all approach from Washington, D.C. The most important thing we do is we drive down costs. You know, the president back in 2008 sounded like a conservative before he was elected on health care. He said that he opposed Senator Clinton's mandate. He said that the problem with health care was that people couldn't afford it. The problem is his bill has been extremely, extremely ideological, extremely liberal in its design, and it's really intended to give government more control of our health care. And then finally, we bring more transparency so that consumers can see and control their health care, the prices, the quality. You know, the left is going to always try to attack whatever conservatives do, but this plan, 16 points, it brings equity in the tax code. It helps folks with pre-existing conditions. One analysis shows it would reduce premiums by $5,000. It's not real complicated. We help people buy their health care so they don't have to buy it only through their employers. We give them that tax advantage deduction so they can buy it on their own. We create cross-state purchasing pools, voluntary purchasing pools. We let people buy insurance across state lines. We crack down on frivolous lawsuits. We allow folks to save money towards wellness programs so they can get healthier. It's not real complicated, but the bottom line is it would save consumers. An average family would save $5,000. It would drive premiums down, save taxpayers money. We can do this. It really goes back to giving patients and their doctors control, not government bureaucrats.
Okay, let me, first of all, if people think this is just pie in the sky, you should go to our website, michaelmedved.com. We're going to link to details about Governor Jindal's plan. And how does this plan deal with what the president initially defined as the biggest problem in American healthcare, which is the fact that there are some 45 to 50 million people who don't have insurance? What would this plan do? Because it does not have an individual mandate. It does not have a law saying you must buy health insurance. How would this deal with the problem of the uninsured?
You know, the president did a good job describing the problems, Michael, of the healthcare system. He said that people can't afford their health care. He said people with pre-existing conditions have trouble. People in the individual market have trouble. But he was right in 08 when he said we don't need a mandate. I mean, the problem with Obamacare is it forces people to buy insurance they may not want, they may not need. There's a reason premiums are going up. There's a reason most of the people in the exchanges weren't previously uninsured. What we do instead, one, we give right now, you don't get tax advantage treatment if you don't buy your health care from your employer. So if your employer doesn't offer health care, you pay more than somebody who gets it through their employer. We give you a standard deduction, so you take it with you across jobs, across state lines. Secondly, we expand the use of health savings accounts so that now you can use those savings to pay for your premiums. Right now you can't do that, and we allow you to vary your deductible in a way the current law doesn't allow you to. For whatever reason, this president doesn't like health savings accounts. He doesn't like empowering individuals. We do. The third thing we do is, in addition to that, we give the states over 10 years, we give them $100 billion to guarantee access to those with pre-existing conditions, because we think states know best how to do this, not the federal government. It may be through reinsurance pools, high-risk pools. States had innovative programs. We also give them more flexibility in their Medicaid programs as well to help meet the needs of those that may get priced out. The next thing we do, right now you can't get the economies of scale if you're an individual trying to buy your own health care. We give folks the opportunity to voluntarily buy their health care across the state lines through purchasing pools. It could be through your alumni association. It could be through your church. It could be through your union. It could be through whatever, your professional trade association. The point is you would get the ERISA protections that folks with large employers get today. You don't get that today. Finally, we also allow folks to buy insurance across state lines. One study shows this could reduce premiums pretty significantly. A lot of folks are living in states today where there's not real competition, where it's not affordable for them to get health care. Several things we do, just the first two things we do alone, the tax deduction and the state pools, that alone, some estimates, independent estimates have shown that would decrease premiums for individuals by 5 to 8% or $5,000 for a family, 7 to 10% for small businesses, not to mention the savings from cracking down on frivolous lawsuits and other reforms that would save literally billions and billions of dollars for consumers. So we make health care. We do what the president said he was going to do. He said he wanted health care to be affordable. Unfortunately, his plan doesn't do that. He said premiums would go down $2,500. CBO says they're going to go up over $2,000.
Who do you believe?
Yeah, that's right. You know, and unfortunately, now the president's realizing, now he's acknowledging people can't keep their doctors, people can't keep their health care plans, premiums aren't going down, broken promise after broken promise used to sell his program.
Okay, Governor Jindal, a lot of people have taken a look, and I know you've acknowledged you're taking a look at the possibility of running for President of the United States when you're done as governor of Louisiana. And there's all this talk out there right now about the battle for the soul of the Republican Party, and it's often defined as a battle between the so-called establishment and the so-called Tea Party. You aren't clearly identified with either side. Do you believe that this all this talk about the Civil War in the Republican Party is overplayed, overdone?
I do, Michael. There are two things. One, I think there's a great civil war going on in the Democratic Party the media doesn't want to cover. So you've got the mayor of New York, de Blasio, waging war on successful charter schools. You've got a Democratic governor trying to stop him from doing that. You've got Democrats not sure. You've got some Democrats that support the president stopping Keystone Pipeline and domestic energy. You've got other Democrats like Manchin in West Virginia and other Democrats in the South saying, well, maybe we shouldn't be putting coal plants out of business. Maybe we shouldn't be cracking down so hard on oil and gas. And so I think that the ideological extremists in the Democratic Party have taken over that party through the Obama administration, whether it's EPA overregulation, whether it's cracking down on domestic oil and gas production, whether it's trying to create obstacles for employment through small businesses, and the media doesn't cover that. As Republicans, as conservatives, what we've got to be all about is growth. We need to be making the point that America can do better. What the president tells the middle class is health care is expensive, college debt is expensive, you're not getting a wage increase at your employer, it's harder to get a job, so the government's going to pay for everything. The American people know that doesn't work. As conservatives, we need to show folks there is a way, there is a conservative path forward that creates good-paying jobs. And by the way, breaks up the monopoly in education. But the most important thing, I think the thing that unifies all of us as conservatives is we believe in personal liberties and freedom. We believe that America can do better by providing better-paying jobs in the private sector, not by growing government.
When we return, is fracking worth it?
A couple years ago, North Dakota as a state was producing about 100,000 barrels a day, not much. They're now at 1 million barrels a day. That's more than two members of OPEC produce.
The townhall.com Weekend Journal continues in a moment. Welcome back to the townhall.com Weekend Journal. I'm Hugh Hewitt. In the world of fuel, with every great technological advance comes the predictable response of environmentalists telling us it will cause the end of the world. Then along comes fracking, a magnificent improvement opening up an incredible ability to pull oil and gas from rocks. Right on cue, the left convulsed, even blaming fracking for recent earthquakes. My friend Dennis Prager spoke with Wall Street Journal reporter Russell Gold, author of the book The Boom, How Fracking Ignited the American Energy Revolution and Changed the World.
Do me and my listeners a favor and explain fracking as if you were writing Fracking for Dummies.
Okay, real simply. You drill a well straight down into the ground, and then you curve that well so you're running through this thick shale rock or some other type rock which has oil and gas in it. And then once you've drilled the well, nothing's going to go into that well because the oil and gas is trapped in this super tight, this super dense rock. So then you pump down water with some chemicals and sand and sort of this frack fluid. You pump it into the well and force it up against like a 200-foot section of rock. And you put so much pressure on that. The best way I can describe it is think about if you're swimming and you go a couple feet down in a swimming pool and you feel pressure in your eardrums when you're 5 feet down. Well, the amount of pressure that you're putting onto that rock is greater than the amount of pressure you would feel if you were sitting on the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico, 12,000 feet down. Just enormous horsepower. And eventually, water doesn't compress. So eventually you push it up against a rock hard enough, the rock's going to give. And it creates this network of fractures that goes all throughout the rock, stretches for a couple hundred feet in every direction. And the oil and gas, so then you pull the water out, and you leave the sand behind to prop open these new cracks. And lo and behold, oil and natural gas starts flowing out of this well. And you've gotten energy from where you were unable to get it before.
And there is so much energy located in those rocks, in that shale rock specifically?
We've turned around U.S. oil production. It was declining, starting in about 2007, 2008. We've gone up 2 million barrels a day. I mean, let me give you and your listeners a sense of just how much oil is there. In the Bakken, which is the oil field in North Dakota.
Wait, forgive me. Is it oil or energy?
Both. It's both. Depends where you go. You go to Pennsylvania, you're usually getting gas out of it. You go to South Texas and North Dakota, you're getting oil out of it. It's the same techniques, just depends on what's in the rock. But you go up to North Dakota, the Bakken,
a couple years ago, 2005, the North Dakota as a state was producing about 100,000 barrels a day, not much. They're now at 1 million barrels a day. That's more than two members of OPEC produce. Then you add into that the Marcellus, this giant gas field in Pennsylvania, the Eagle Ford in South Texas, and you begin to understand just how much oil and gas is out there. The U.S. has now become the largest oil and gas producer in the world, if you combine those two. Saudi Arabia still produces more oil.
Why are we importing then?
Well, we still need a lot more oil than we use.
Now, what was the objection of the anti-frackers?
Well, it really begins talking about water. The first thing you hear is a lot of talk about water. Then when it became clear that there were just, you know, we weren't talking about water wells everywhere going bad, that these were very limited instances and it was fairly easy to wrap our arms around and fix, then you heard a lot about air emissions and now you're hearing about earthquakes. So it's there's been a sort of a moving target being placed on fracking by many of the fracktivists and the people who oppose it.
Right. Well, what's wrong with the water? I don't follow.
Well, there had been some instances in Pennsylvania where water wells, these are rural water wells, had suddenly gotten methane in them, gotten natural gas in them, or had other contaminants. And there were charges that, well, fracking itself was causing the problem. The answer is no. Fracking isn't causing the problem. If you build the well that you're going to be drilling down into poorly, well, yes, you might create a pathway for some chemicals or some contaminated water, briny water maybe, to come up the backside of the well. So there's been there is and continues to be a focus on building wells properly, making sure that wells have good integrity so that doesn't happen. I can tell you there is some good news, though. When the United States produces more oil and gas, the volatility has gone away. These sudden $20 price swings in oil have gone away because we're not so tight anymore in this global oil picture. I mean, a few years ago, 2005, 2006, we'd have a hurricane come through the Gulf of Mexico and knock out 1 million barrels a day, and we just didn't have the spare capacity globally, and prices would go way up. We're not at that point anymore, and that's a good thing.
How far down is fracking? How far below the surface?
Depends where you go, but you're talking 2 miles easily.
It's astonishing.
Coming up, is Hillary a viable presidential candidate?
She has so much more baggage and is so much less appealing than the first George Bush was that she's going to run into a lot of trouble.
A look at who's who in 2016 when the townhall.com Weekend Journal returns in a moment. Welcome back to the townhall.com Weekend Journal. I'm your host, Hugh Hewitt. 2016 is a long ways away. And 2016 will be here in the blink of an eye. Even though the midterm elections are still over 6 months out, the presidential candidates are jockeying for position as 2016 quickly approaches. I discussed the likely candidates with Fred Barnes, executive editor of the Weekly Standard.
Molly Ball over at the Atlantic has a piece on the Freedom Rally that was held in New Hampshire this past weekend with Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, and a bunch of other people, including Mike Huckabee and Donald Trump. And her conclusion is Ted Cruz crushes Rand Paul when the Tea Party gets together and votes. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that, but so what?
Well, so what is Iowa and South Carolina? So what?
Well, I don't know that. Is Ted Cruz going to be a huge factor in those races? Maybe so. But I do agree that he's a guy who can fire up grassroots Republicans in a way that Rand Paul cannot.
And that
Rand Paul sounds, I mean, you get to foreign policy, he sounds like Barack Obama. He's a leading from behind guy.
And so when you look at the map and it goes Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, isn't Cruz really set up to at least win two out of three of those things?
How do we know that now? I mean, that's so far off. And besides, I think I've told you once about, this was some months ago when Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio appeared together at an event. It was to raise money for veterans. And Ted Cruz gave his standard speech. Marco Rubio, which was pretty good, the Cruz speech, no question about it. Marco Rubio gave a special speech for that event, made news, and was just a stronger figure and a better speaker. So Marco Rubio may well be in there. In fact, I think he probably will be. And then and Ted Cruz will be diminished as a result.
Well, you're reading my notes here, because if Ted Cruz becomes the candidate of the Tea Party, the establishment needs someone. And after Ryan Liz's piece, I really do think Chris Christie is bleeding out before our eyes after reading that piece. And Jeb Bush's, what'd you make of Jeb's act of love speech?
Well, I wouldn't have used that phrase, but look, that's who he is. And whether that means he's going to run or not run, I mean, I think he's out there talking up the real Jeb Bush, who I would say, being a homeowner in Florida, he was a great governor. He's more libertarian than his brother, and he's much more of a reformer on Medicaid and taxes and a lot of other things. And he is a very much a liberal on immigration. I think he tried out that, and the truth is, with most Republicans I've talked to, it didn't go over well. I liked it, but I'm a minority on this.
So am I. I know what he meant. It was a rusty speech. He's rusty, if nothing else. Have you had a chance yet, Fred Barnes? I'm going to talk with Jonathan Allen of Reuters, of Bloomberg, I mean, later in the week about the new book, HRC, which he co-authored with Amy Parnt. It's a pretty riveting book. Have you had a chance to read it yet?
I haven't had a chance to read it. I've read a few reviews, and you, I'm surprised that you're reading some pro-Hillary book.
It's not what I thought it was going to be. It's actually kind of an Oppo researcher's dream for reason, which will become evident. But it's clear to me that Hillary is George Herbert Walker Bush, 1988. She's the designated successor to the revolutionary figure with the long Rolodex and the donor list and the caution. And it worked for her HW. Do you think it's going to work for her?
I really don't. I think she has so much more baggage and is so much less appealing than the first George Bush was, that she's going to run into a lot of trouble. I didn't realize that book. Maybe I should retract what I said about it. I didn't realize it was an Oppo expert's dream, and I'm sure all the Oppo people in the Republican Party and in the Democratic Party will be looking for that.
Oh, I'm telling just the story on how she stopped serious Iranian sanctions and how she got the START treaty that should never have been signed if the record was known to people.
Of course, a terrible treaty. I mean, the only things we know about her as Secretary of State, I think you're suggesting, and I would agree, are bad things.
Yep.
I mean, what were her great achievements for peace and in the American interest? I can't think of any.
Now, take a look at this book. If you review this, I think you'll come to the same conclusion I did, is that they may have thought they were writing a pro-Hillary book, but it is not a pro-Hillary book. All right, Fred, I want to turn to an inside baseball story, the kind that you know better than anyone. There was a story in the Wall Street Journal on Friday about an obscure agency called the Export-Import Bank, which I support, but it talked about how Jeb Hensarling of Texas, who's a senior Republican congressman and loved by conservatives, a friend of the show and a good guy, is trying to kill it, and how Eric Cantor is trying to save it, and that this is a proxy battle for the successor to John Boehner. Cantor versus Hensarling, who wins?
You know, that would be one. I agree. I think it is a proxy battle if Boehner decides not to be speaker anymore, run for re-election and win, and then drop out, either resign or not, but drop out as speaker. And that'll be a close race, but I think Cantor wins because Cantor has been working on this longer and harder than Hensarling has. But Hensarling will have a lot of support. He's extremely well-liked. He's just not very well-known outside the Republican caucus.
Now, if John Boehner wanted Cantor to succeed him, and by all indications he does, would Cantor be better off if the speaker stepped down before November and allowed that election to happen with the caucus Cantor knows rather than the caucus that will have new faces in it?
It'll have some new faces. I'm not sure it really makes any difference. I mean, it'll be a different caucus for Hensarling as well. But those are the expected two combatants. And look, I don't think I'm underestimating Hensarling, but it's just that Cantor has been prepping for this to become to succeed Boehner for so long, and has developed many allies. Many more allies than I think Hensarling has inside the Republican caucus that he's likely to win. But as far as Cantor goes, I guess, as I'm thinking quickly here, probably the sooner the better.
Yeah, and last question on the two.
For him.
Who gets the votes of the defense hawks between Cantor and Hensarling?
to the extent they vote on that, it's probably Hensarling.
Why do you think that? Because I was thinking that Cantor would benefit being from Virginia and the defense industry down there, and he's been good on the Navy and stuff like that.
Because Texans are tougher on defense than Virginians often are. I don't know that that will be an issue that is a big distinction between the two and something that people are going to vote on. But one thing we'll learn from this, if this happens, if there's a race between Hensarling and Cantor, is that all of a sudden people will find out that Jeb Hensarling is a major figure in the Republican Party.
Coming up.
Aside from everything else, he hurt himself.
Dennis Prager takes a look at a shocking statement from baseball great Henry Aaron in our final segment of the townhall.com Weekend Journal. Welcome back to the townhall.com Weekend Journal. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Sadly, Obamacare surrogates have increased their tactic of turning sincere opposition to his policies into a race issue. That's as dishonest as it is divisive. Unfortunately, the tactic has spread. Even legendary baseball great Henry Aaron, admired by millions of fans, many of them Republicans, got caught up in the rhetoric of the left, comparing those who disagree with Obama to members of, yes, the KKK. Here's Dennis Prager.
Hank Aaron compares Republicans that oppose Obama to the Ku Klux Klan? You know, when I saw that headline, you didn't even want to send it to me. I don't blame you. Exactly, I loved him. My heart sank. Well, it takes your breath away. Aside from everything else, he hurt himself. So why do attacks on the president emanate from racism? What is the point of making that point? Either you believe it, in which case you live in a delusion, or you don't believe it, in which case you're being demagogic to protect the left and the president specifically. So now Hank Aaron, in a sense, will, for this individual, have an asterisk next to his name. Wonderful player. And then I can't say the entirety of his life renders him a jerk. A human being is more than one bad moment. But it comes with an asterisk. Speaking to USA Today, on the 40th anniversary of his then record-breaking 715th home run, the 80-year-old Aaron said that Republicans are hindering Obama's job performance. Sure, this country has a black president, but when you look at a black president, President Obama's left with his foot stuck in the mud from all of the Republicans with the way he's treated. Aaron continued, "The bigger difference is that back then they had hoods. Now they have neckties and starched shirts." And then there's the usual line on this matter. "We have moved in the right direction and there have been improvements, but we still have a long ways to go in the country," talking about race relations. What does that mean? What would you like, Mr. Aaron, the average non-black in America to do? You know, whenever I read these things, I have done something. I don't know how many other whites do this or non-blacks, but I do this. I average 2 flights every week. I average about 100 flights a year. So I watch at airports, for example, I will watch very carefully how is any given black treated by any given white. I am hypersensitive on his or her behalf to any sense, and people don't know I'm watching, obviously, to any sense that the person is being treated in any way differently.
Thank you for joining us on the townhall.com Weekend Journal. Warm greetings from Salem Communications and townhall.com to all of you celebrating Easter and observing Passover this weekend. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Join us again next week for another edition of the Town Hall Weekend Journal, the weekend news program from a perspective you can trust.